Hey, listeners. Today's episode is brought to you by Kind Bar. Kind is deeply committed to crafting food with real recognizable ingredients, a disruptive notion that sparked the creation of a new healthy snacking category. Kind is unapologetic in their efforts to challenge the status quo, to shift the food industry and empower the community and our listeners to make better, more informed choices about their health. Kindness can be a transformative force for good, and that is why we are teaming up with Kind to bring our listeners 10% off or 15% off for military, teachers, students, first responders, doctors, and nurses. Go to podgo.co/kind. That's podgo.co/kind. Kind Bar, creating a kinder and healthier world, one act, one snack at a time. Welcome back, Inebriates. This is Andy, the Inebriar Podcast. And today we brought on a guest who producer Fish is a big fan of. Seth Dickinson, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
No problem, man. So you are writer, novelist. Is that the best kind of description of what it is that you do?
Yeah, my two big things are I write novels and I write a lot of video game lore, which is a very weird niche field, because I don't really write the scripts for games or what actually happens in them. I write the random crap you find lying around in the world or the backstory or whatever.
So that's something kind of new that I have in the past year or so kind of realized was a thing. I didn't realize, you know, I grew up on Pitfall. Pitfall didn't need a writer. And I first came exposed to Matt Koval through his YouTube channel. He's talking about how he's a video game writer. Do all video games have writers now? I mean, not to sound completely naive, but like I said, it's a new thing for me.
Probably not all. I would say that games that want to be like filmic, like The Last of Us, where they really want to have a story with defined characters, and they all have writers. But then games like Minecraft, where it's very systems driven. Mm-hmm. Don't really need a writer. There will still be game strings, which are like descriptions of items and stuff. So I don't know if you've ever heard of Dark Souls. It's a popular franchise. One thing they're famous for is that a lot of their storytelling is done through the item descriptions and the load screens. So it's very possible. Like, you won't understand what's happening in the world unless you pay close attention to this like ball of rags you found or whatever. And it's possible that they actually don't have a writer for those, and that the designers, the people making the game, just write the stuff. So, no, not all games have writers.
And, you know, I have tons of friends who are gamers, and sometimes you'll end up sitting with them, and they'll be playing a game, and they'll come up to a non-player character, and the character will start to speak, and it's just like, skip, 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 skip.
Right.
Is that insulting? Is that frustrating? Or is it just a different style of play?
It's not insulting, I don't think. I think there's a tension in games between, like, in the ideal video game made by God the Omnipotent, with no constraints at all, there would be no writing. Not because writing is bad, but because the characters would be self-aware and would generate dialogue based on their, like, motives and the game state and stuff. So the reason I say that is, like, in a sense, all linear writing in games, like something somebody sat down at a computer and typed out that doesn't change in response to the player's actions, is a failure of the game. Ideally, everything about a game would respond to the player's decisions. There would be something the character could say that was unique to you. But because we're human beings and we make games with, you know, limited budgets and limited time, at some point you just have to have a character like speak a string of words, and it's the same every time for every player. And then of course they skip it. That's understandable. Maybe they listen on the first time through. Maybe they just don't think it's important and they want to get back to interacting with the game systems. There are a lot of different psychologies of game players, and I do not resent the ones who want to just skip the dialogue, but I would say if a game has a great story the story should exist enough in the game mechanics and what you do in the game that you can't help but pick up some of the mood and some of the characters just through exposure to the world and through the actions you're taking as the player.
And was this like a field that you're like, oh, I'm going to get into this, or did it just kind of more happen?
Absolutely not. I quit a PhD program and I had nothing to do with my life. So I applied to work at this game studio that they'd made games. They made Halo, which I was a fan of when I was a kid. So I was like, cool, I'll try to go work on their next game. And I was very lucky to get a job there, but also very unlucky because working in video games sucks. And
it sucks, and it seems like every teenager I talk to wants to do it.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what to tell them.
So what games have you worked on?
I have literally only worked on Destiny. So okay. Destiny's expansions, Destiny 2 and its expansions. And I've done a little work for this game Godfall, which is coming out on PS5. And this indie game I really loved called House of the Dying Sun, which is kind of this weird space shooter by Mike Tipple, who was an ex-Bungie guy I met. I like that game. A little anecdote. I had a really weird, unique experience playing House of the Dying Sun for the first time at PAX in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And because it's a game set in the cockpit of a spaceship, and he demoed it as a VR game, so you wear like a headset. So it's like you're literally sitting in the cockpit of the spaceship. Well, when you're in a spaceship, there's no up and down, and you want to see as much of the field of play as possible because, you know, you want to be aware of what's going on. So the most natural way to look is straight up because your spaceship is blocking the view below, but your cockpit is open above.
So I see what you're saying.
I found myself just looking like a complete idiot while playing this game because I was just staring straight up at the ceiling the whole time. Gave myself a terrible neck cramp. It's very weird. A lot of fun, though.
You just made me think of just prior to COVID breaking out, I went and saw this Irish stand-up comedian. His name's Dara O'Brien, and he was here in Boston, and he's a huge video game fan, and he was talking about how VR will never quite take off like people seem to think it is, because in his opinion, all technological advancements come through porn. And he's like, no one's really willing to be that submerged into porn. He's like, you're going to take your headset off after you're done, and there's going to be like a cop standing there and being like, you've been a hostage for like 2 hours and no one has been able to get a hold of you, and you didn't even know, and you're on the news. And it was a really, really funny bit.
Have you seen you watch Black Mirror?
Oh, yeah. I didn't watch the last season, because by the time I had free time to watch it, we were already in lockdown. And I'm like, I don't have the mental fortitude to watch Black Mirror in the middle of a lockdown. Things need to be happy.
Yeah, I don't blame you. There is one episode, I think, in the last season called Striking Vipers, which is about, it's kind of about the a weird eroticism of like teenagers getting together and playing these fighting games where they're kind of beating the shit out of each other with these very highly sexualized characters. Mm-hmm. And the plot is basically these two friends reconnect over the latest version of this fighting game, which is super immersive VR. And it gets weird immediately when they start having sex in the game, which apparently the game allows you to do. And it was a great episode. A little sad. But also sort of tender in a weird way.
That's the best way to describe Black Mirror. Sad yet tender in a weird way. So we were just talking just prior to hitting record that you had a new book come out just a couple weeks ago. I believe this episode's going up in quite a few weeks, so it'll be maybe a month or so ago. But can you tell us about that book?
Yeah, it's the third book in this series about Baru Cormorant, the title character. She's basically a little girl on this island when a colonial empire rolls in. You know, like colonial era Britain or the Dutch.
Oh, yeah.
It's more that than like Mongols invading. Okay. And at first, things are very good. They kind of come into her island with vaccines and dentistry, and they're very positive. But she figures out pretty quickly that they're going to take over the island's economy and basically turn them into a plantation. And she decides the best way for her to stop this empire, kind of like, you remember in Star Wars, Luke's original plan was to go to the Imperial Flight School. He was going to be an Imperial fighter pilot.
Yeah, he was going to be a bad guy.
Yeah. So what she does is she decides to join the Imperial Civil Service, and she becomes an accountant. And her plan is to try to take the empire down from the inside. And the first problem she hits is that she's sent to this kind of remote province to deal with a rebellion there, to prove her loyalty, basically, and move on to bigger and better things where she can actually help her home. But she falls for the Duchess, who's leading the rebellion, and her life gets very, very complicated from there.
So I got to say, that sounds like a very brave choice to write a novel about an accountant. It doesn't scream action and adventure.
No, it's definitely something I'm aware of writing. Like, people are going to assume this is boring, but if you watch great intrigue television, like, mm-hmm. violence, sex, and money are the cornerstones of trashy, cheap thrills. So there's actually a lot to get at there. I don't know if you like John le Carre, but John le Carre has a couple great novels that have been turned into great films where the climax is like somebody signing a piece of paper, and it's incredibly tense. It's unbelievable.
So is it more kind of like a procedural mystery solving kind of thing? That kind of... intrigue?
No. I would actually compare it a little bit to Game of Thrones if the main character were in the Iron Bank. I don't know if you're a Game of Thrones fan, but...
I was very much enjoying the show. I never read the books. And there was so much hate about the last season that I just kind of have yet to watch it.
Right. Well, I think one of the reasons people didn't like the last season, one of the less talked about ones, is it stopped being a show about the way power flows and the way structures interact, and became a show about just a small group of people making weird decisions. So a lot of the complaints about the last season are like, how did this fleet of ships get from point A to point B so fast? One of the things people liked about the show was that it took being in this pseudo medieval world seriously. It took questions like, how are we going to survive the winter if we've razed all our fields in the Civil War? Or where are we going to get the money to pay our army? Very, very seriously. And in the era of history George R. R. Martin's working from, those were huge questions. Like the ability of any feudal lord to levy an army from like your farmers was basically limited to a couple months a year because they had to go home and do the harvest. And if you stop them from doing that, your military dissolved.
Right, because then you're not going to have food to feed your army.
Right.
And your people, yeah.
Yes.
So do you the novel that you just wrote, is that set in like a fantasy world like R. Martin, or is that more like a historic fiction?
It's not set on Earth. Okay. I would say it's like George R. R. Martin with a bit less magic. Yeah.
Okay. And so do you try to really flush out that realistic power structure that's in play to make it more believable, or is that just kind of what interests you?
I try to flesh it out enough to make a good story, but not so much that it becomes exhausting and like reading an RPG source book. So did you see The Big Short?
The Big Short? No, I didn't.
Oh, well, it's a pretty good movie. Yeah. It's a very funny movie and very interesting. And basically what it's about is why the world economy collapsed in 2007. And what incredibly stupid reasons were behind the destruction of like an entire generation's economic potential. And it dramatizes that very well. And it does so by explaining very boring sounding things like collateralized debt obligations. What the fuck is that?
Yeah.
In a way that's intuitive and interesting. And it turns out actually what a collateralized debt obligation is it's people's mortgages. It's hundreds or thousands of mortgages given to people who can't actually afford the mortgage, like strippers, or nothing against strippers, but people who don't have steady incomes and are not ready to buy a house. And the people who sell these houses then take all the mortgages. And this was something I had to understand from my book. You can sell debt. You can transfer debt to other people. And all that means is you're taking the promise that Bob over there is going to pay me, and you're selling that promise to someone else. So Bob now has to pay them. And what that means is if you sell a bad mortgage, by which I mean a mortgage nobody's going to repay, you know, you sold them a house and the promise they're going to give you $100,000, but you know they're never going to give you $100,000. Then you sell that promise for $10,000. You made $10,000 for no risk. Somebody else is now the person who's not going to get paid that $100,000. And you walk away fine. The person eventually loses their house, and the person who was supposed to get paid the mortgage gets screwed over. All the collateralized debt obligations are is bundles of thousands of those bad mortgages sold together to banks by people who are like, hey, I can make free money by selling people houses, then giving up all the risk to these banks. When the mortgages go bad, the people lose their homes, the banks collapse. Everyone depending on the banks is shit out of luck, but I'm rich.
But I have $8 million from selling all these debt obligations to what? Yeah, that's pretty messed up.
Yeah, and the thing about that is once you explain it in terms of people losing their homes and people getting screwed over, readers really just care about people. As long as you can explain why a weird abstract system matters to people, the readers will follow you. They'll like the stuff.
How do you try to get your readers to connect to your characters? Do you try to, like, I remember hearing, I'm a big Lord of the Rings fan, I don't remember where exactly I heard it, but someone said that Samwise is the character that, like, is the main character because he's the character we can all relate to, because, you know, even kind of Bilbo's from an upper class family, and, you know, Sam is, Frodo is from an upper class family, and Sam is the gardener. So he's kind of the everyman. So he's the one that we're supposed to relate to. How do you try to kind of make the reader connect to your characters?
So there's a big conversation that's constantly ongoing, like this endless tropical storm, about whether characters need to be likable. And I don't think the way to connect a reader to a character is to make them like the character. Sometimes that works. Sam is really, really likable because he's completely loyal. But, you know, if you knew Sam in real life, you'd probably be like, this Frodo guy walks all over you. You know, stand up for yourself a little. Sam might get a little irritating. He'd be your best friend if he were your best friend. But if he was someone else's friend, you might feel a little bad for him. Sorry, I don't mean to talk shit about Samwise.
Oh, no. That's fine.
But another example of a character people really find compelling is Walter White from Breaking Bad. Or Tony Soprano from The Sopranos, who are despicable people. They're horrible. They're not even arguably good people where they're, you know, trying to do something, but they're making tough decisions to do it, which is a whole other can of worms. These people are just awful. They're awful people, but they're very compelling people because they make interesting decisions and we want to see the consequences of their actions. And we're kind of waiting for the day when it all comes due, when they have to face up to what they've done. So that's one way to make a character compelling, is to just build a pile of lies and shortcuts and cheats that they've committed and wait for it all to come crashing down on them. People want that moment of catharsis. But another way is to give them something they really want, but constantly deny themselves, because even though it's something they want, they think it's not something they need or they shouldn't have. What are some easy examples of that? You know, in a lot of mob stories, the character wants to get out and have a family and have a normal life, but they keep finding reasons not to do it. Or in Baru's case, you know, she's in love with this woman and wants to be with this woman, but she keeps finding excuses to not do it because it's against her grand plan or whatever. The human heart in conflict with itself is, somebody said, the source of good literature.
And that seems to, you know, that's something that I think everyone can relate to, because you get people who, you know, they want, you know, oh, this is the career I want, but this is the career I have and can't really get out of that, you know. So I feel like we can all relate to that. I want something, but for social norms or, you know, obligation, I can't change.
Yeah. I think another thing also that people really like is seeing an unexpected depth is maybe the wrong word, but an unexpected aspect of a character who seems like a stock figure. Mm-hmm. So we all run into stock figures every day. You know, somebody at the DMV is giving us a hard time and can't give us what we want, and we hate them. But then something happens to remind you this is another person, another human being with their own interiority, and they're capable of kindness and compassion, and they're basically as much of a slave to the situation as you are. And having those little moments of Sonder where you realize that a side character in a book actually has their own story going on, and maybe the reason they seem like a jerk to our protagonist is because they're in pain, or maybe a character we expect to be cruel is unexpectedly kind. Having those little moments of dimensionality is really important to me, and I think really helps sell a story as more than just a script. It gives you the illusion that these characters and people actually exist in some living way, that they're able to do things that are unexpected and provide these moments of grace and hope and compassion where you might expect just misery and punishment. Which is something I also find a lot in history. I read a lot of history stuff, and it's always very weird when historical characters do reasonably decent things despite being awful people. Just reading a history of Genghis Khan's daughters, and Genghis Khan is like the most notorious rapist in human history.
Yeah,
I would say. But he was actually a kind of Mongol proto-feminist. He had very strong rules about the role of women in Mongol society. He just only cared about Mongol women, his daughters and his relatives. So it's very strange to read him proclaim these laws about how to treat women respectfully when you know his conduct in war is also using mass rape as a weapon.
It's funny. We just did a podcast episode on one of our other shows, and it was about Whitey Bulger, and it was people either thought he was like this Robin Hood character that was, you know, keeping money in the community and helping out those people that were overlooked by society, or he was a horrible, horrible monster. And I think I love villains that, like, I don't want to say I don't believe in evil. I don't believe evil believes it's evil. And perfect example is Thanos. In the Avengers movies, Thanos is the hero to himself.
Right.
You know, and I think that makes for such a compelling villain, because it's not just I'm doing evil for the sake of evil. It's I'm doing this evil thing because it's the only thing that I see as the only good possible outcome.
Yeah. So I actually want to talk about Boston and Whitey Bulger, but first,
oh, sure, yeah.
Thanos is a great example of, so one thing I would say about characters is that I'm a strong proponent of the belief that like good and evil are not really immiscible. They're not things that you can wash together. It's not like a person is a pool of paint and you pour all the different colors of their decisions in and you get a shade of brown. People can do great, good things and then also do things that are horrible enough to condemn them and make them bad people. And they don't cancel each other out, even though in general, because it's so much more important to not do harm, we tend to weight the bad decisions more heavily, like mm-hmm. rightly so, I think.
Yeah.
Thanos is an interesting example where inside the narrative, he is this very reasonably well-rendered charismatic figure who has a clear ideology, which he believes in wholeheartedly and is willing to sacrifice for. And his ideology is basically, we need to reduce the number of people and things out there using stuff so that the universe is more sustainable and there won't be as much suffering.
Right.
And inside the narrative, that works great. He's great. Josh Brolin's performance is great. But then you get this weird element of, and here we get into the question of what is a writer's responsibility to the real world, where in real life, the idea that overpopulation is a source of the world's problems is a lie. And Thanos's ideology, if applied to the real world, would be wrong and stupid, because the vast majority of resource consumption and environmental destruction isn't caused by hordes of poor people. It's caused by a very few elite power holders. So mm-hmm. if we had a real world Thanos, the only thing for him to do that makes sense would be to like attack the capitalist elite or the whatever is to lead, you know, the people in charge of resource distribution and consumption. So then you find yourself asking, like, did the writers of Thanos have a responsibility to more accurately portray the problems of resource depletion? I don't have an answer to that.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But you said you wanted to mention Whitey Bulger.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I grew up with a family that constantly commuted between Boston and Vermont. And mm-hmm. so I heard a lot about Whitey when I was a kid. My grandfather was obsessed with him. So you're Boston area. Whereabouts?
Yeah, Plymouth.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I go up there occasionally. It's a weird city to get around because I live in New York and I'm used to the subways and I've totally forgotten how to drive. If you put me in a car, I would kill everyone nearby.
Yeah, Boston takes a map and some experience.
Yes, or an Uber.
Or Uber.
No, actually, a big part of my childhood memories of those commutes is listening to my parents argue about what to do on, like, Sturo Drive or Memorial. Because I would always insist we go to the Boston Science Museum, and then it's hell getting out of there to the highway.
Oh, yeah. It's hell getting in and out of there pretty much. Unless wherever you're going is right off the highway. Like, yeah. The theater district's not too bad because you can usually get within, like, two blocks and find a parking garage. But, yeah, it's kind of a mess. Especially, I don't know how old you are, but when I was in high school, it was like prime Big Dig.
Big Dig, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So the exit was there one day, and now it's gone, and yeah. So,
hey, you got a nice bridge out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's you can get through it pretty quick now as long as, you know, they haven't had anyone killed by falling debris in a while. So, but so when you were that age, were you already thinking of a career in writing, or was it just something you did, or had you even like done any of it yet?
Yeah, I, God, you'll hear this from a lot of writers and it's always insufferable, but I did always write as a kid. I mostly wrote novels about my Lego spaceships. I would build spaceships out of Legos and yep. Write stories about what they were up to. And then I got involved in a website where grown men made spaceships with Lego computer modeling programs and wrote stories about what happened with them.
nothing wrong with that. I used to own a comic book shop, and when I did, I had quite an extensive Lego collection.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, this novel I have coming out, hopefully next year, it's been bought by Tor, but the coronavirus has screwed up the whole publishing pipeline. It's actually a de-Legoed version of my High School Bionicle fan fiction.
okay.
Which you would never guess by reading it. It's very serious and mature and is about, like, America's responsibility to the Kurds and, you know, the nature of difficult decisions in wartime and whether the universe has an intrinsic morality. You'd never guess it's based on Lego Bionicles, but it absolutely was. Before I dressed it up all nice-like.
So I feel like you are, at very least, somewhat experienced in role-play games.
Not really. I mean, I've played some computer RPGs. I ran a couple, you know, role-playing games when I was a teenager, but I wouldn't call myself hugely experienced. I'm not part of this whole, like, D&D boom that's happened lately with streams and podcasts and stuff.
I feel like when I talk to people that are, like, really interested in, like, power struggles and political intrigue and how it fits with the overall social justice, a lot of them kind of work that into their RPGs where you're fighting against the, you know, tyrants and whatnot. Where do you kind of find your inspiration for the settings and social structures in your novels? And, like, do you try to kind of world build them and work them out ahead of time? That's kind of where I was going with the role-playing game thing.
Yeah. I think almost all world building, I'm a contrarian, so naturally I think almost all world building is done wrong. And
yeah, I've been told I constantly say things are wrong whenever someone says anything.
I think first the whole idea of world building, quote unquote, comes from a really specific, I'm going to go there, a very imperialistic idea of how we have knowledge about things and societies. There's this great book, which I haven't finished yet, so I'm a poser, called Seeing Like a State, which is basically about how the question that impelled the book was, why do all these efforts to improve the human condition go so horribly wrong? And the answer the book comes up with is basically large powers, like states, attempt to render human existence legible, by which I mean they try to force people to live in such a way that their lives can be converted into taxable income, censuses, you know, specific territories they live on. With the original examples being like the Chinese trying to get nomadic people to settle down and be counted, lots mm-hmm. of examples like that. And they then use the data they gather and how people live to make decisions. You know, you basically abstract the world into a set of data, manipulate the data according to some set of assumed rules, get a good outcome, and then you try to implement it on the people you rule. And it turns out your model of how people behave is totally wrong. And your attempts at legibility and understanding how people live are defective and don't capture everything about people's lives. So the solutions you provide are terrible. One example would be, you know, the British in the Raj, their colonial rule of India, offering a bounty for dead rats. They were like, give us rat tails and we'll pay you to help wipe out all the rats. People immediately began farming thousands of rats because they were like, oh, cool. We get money for rats.
Let's so make just more grow rats. Them. Yeah.
Yeah. Another class that I don't know much about of example of this is something called a work to rules strike, which is where laborers in a factory do their jobs exactly as instructed on, you know, training material or whatever. But because no training procedure ever fully includes every single step literally required to do the job, there's some element of human knowledge passed directly from people to people. Inevitably, the factory breaks down because these people are not really doing everything that has to be done. My point is, taking this top-down view of, we'll make a fantasy world based on what I, the author, know about the world, mm-hmm. is it's an epistemic lie. It doesn't make any sense. You can't make a world based entirely on what you know. There's no way an entire world, an entire culture, can fit inside the knowledge of one person, or even the knowledge of a group of anthropologists. So what you have to do is try to build a world with enough fuzz and weird stuff and flex that it feels like that the lie you sell to the reader is you are getting the author's view of the world plus a little more, things the author doesn't know and doesn't understand, but which still creep into the story from outside. Does that make any sense? Like, if I wrote a book set in Kurdistan, which I have, I would get a million things wrong, a billion things, because I don't live in Kurdistan. I don't understand all the tribes and customs and languages and history. But if I were to attempt to write a fantasy novel set in a place like Kurdistan, what I would have to do as a quote-unquote world builder is not mimetically understand every single tribe and all their languages and where they came from. I would have to intentionally put into the world building these cracks and crevices and gray spaces where I don't know what happened, but the world knows. All right, let me try to give a specific example. There should be customs in your world that do not make sense.
Okay.
Just as there are in the real world, because they are the product of hundreds of years of history and weird cultural distortion. And their memories of practices, which were once very real and applied, like, I don't know, like, not eating shellfish or something.
Or like a Christmas tree?
Yeah.
Cutting down a tree and bringing it inside your house and decorating it, which really makes no real sense.
Right. And even there, you have to get into the question of, like, is this whole modern Christmas celebration a Roman, like, was it a stolen Roman festival? The Christians were like, sure, we'll put Jesus's birthday here because people already celebrate stuff, so it's right. A good fit. And B, early 20th century advertisers doing branding. Like, I don't think an author doing world building for a fictional setting is often going to be like, this holiday that everybody celebrates ritually and is about the birth of Jesus is not actually on the birth of Jesus. Jesus maybe didn't exist and was a composite figure based on multiple people. That's a really controversial claim. Like, but I'm just
and the holidays on. Really like an amalgam of four different holidays from like
right from four ancient religions,
yeah,
that nobody even remembers because none of that really makes sense to a reader. They're going to be like, what do you mean you celebrate this religion, this major religious holiday on a day when the event didn't actually happen, and it's not clear the event actually happened at all, and it's based on these four other ancient mythologies you haven't told me about.
And if you ever try to explain all that, they'd be like, oh, this is so wordy.
Exactly. Yeah. It would be boring and confusing. But you have to have that kind of chaos in your world. It seems like chaos to us from our, you know, our modern historical perspectives, for it to feel anything like authentic and real. So the reason I say world building is done wrong and it's imperialistic is that it's an attempt to top down know everything that happens in a world. And you can't do that. What you have to do is acknowledge that there are these crazy historical processes that produce a lot of unknowability. And you have to make room in your worlds for that, where a common problem in world building in science fiction and fantasy stories is one character will ask another, why does this thing happen? Or how does it work? Or what do we do? And the other character will explain. Whereas in real life, if I'm walking down the street and I grab someone, or I don't know, we hit it off and have coffee, and I'm like, so where does the money come from for bank loans? Nobody knows that. I mean, there's a simple explanation, like the Federal Reserve or whatever, or money is printed. But ask somebody that question, and they're probably not going to explain fractional reserve banking or the velocity of money or whatever in a clear, coherent way. People don't know how the world works. Having characters explain how the world works is itself kind of a lie. Anyway. So that's why I think world building needs room for stuff. It needs to have things the author doesn't know built in.
Do you find it easier that way when you're writing a series or even like working on a specific novel, because it's easier to kind of retrofit things in that you may have not realized you needed at the time?
No, I don't think so. I think it's way harder. And it's not like a cheat to make it easier to fit things in later. It's almost fractal. Like, you know, the principle of a fractal is as you zoom in, you continue to discover more detail, mm-hmm. like the Mandelbrot set. What's exhausting about this approach as a writer is every single time you turn the narrative camera on a new piece of culture or territory, you have to come up with another set of weird cultural norms. And because if you zoom in on almost any part of human behavior, you find all these strange things that are connected to everything else. So having to do that everywhere you look in a book is complicated and effortful. And I'm always worried I'm going to get lazy and just steal something directly from history, which in a few cases I have. But for an alternate secondary world to seem authentic, it needs to have its own contingency. It needs to have its own weird past events that have shaped the present. For example, one thing I constantly think about is, for some reason, we don't know why, it might have been a volcanic eruption, but it actually probably wasn't. Humans are incredibly inbred. Okay. We as a species are descended from a fairly small population of past humans. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's true, but the soundbite I hear a lot is that two chimps living on opposite sides of a river are more distantly related than the two most distantly related human beings.
Oh, like, really?
Our entire genetic diversity fits in that river between two chimpanzees. And this is an incredibly consequential thing for our existence today, the fact that we're not very genetically diverse. I don't know to what extent it allows us to have like human rights and a very important belief that we're all equal, but it certainly plays a role. Like, I thank God, I'm an atheist, but you know, I'm very grateful that we have no subspecies or, I don't know, distinct genetic populations to treat like shit, because we treat everybody like shit already. So
even though they're so similar, right? Yeah.
Right. So in a fantasy world, how do you get these inbred humans? You need to have a similar reason in their deep geological evolutionary past for something to have happened to make them all inbred. that's a problem.
Is there, there's tons of, you know, fantasy tropes, but is there like one that's a real pet peeve that you really work to avoid, or whenever you see it you get really frustrated? Is it being hacky? Or
no, I don't really believe in tropes. I don't really think that it's fun to pull little modular bits of narrative out of their context and be like, hey, it's the same in these 25 stories. But I don't ever think you can actually deal with a storytelling tool separate from its context. So that goes two ways. I do believe in statistics. If somebody comes to me and is like, hey, in these randomly selected 500 fantasy novels, only 80 have gay characters, and in 75% of them, at least one of the gay characters dies by the end. I'm like, okay, I see a trend there. There's a real pattern. But in terms of tropes, like...
I'll give you an example of a trope that when I first saw it, I was so frustrated. I was watching, this is the first time I was watching Firefly, and at the time I was watching it with my now ex-wife, and in the beginning of an episode, this woman at this like small village festival puts a wreath on Malcolm Reynolds' head and gives him a bowl, and he drinks from it. And I turn to my wife and I go, if they're married because of that, I'm going to be so pissed off because that's so cheap. But Joss Whedon is so good. By the end of it, I'm like, I think this is my favorite episode, because he kind of led you down that, oh, they're married, and then put in a great twist.
Yeah, and I haven't I haven't watched Firefly since I was a teenager. But if I recall, sorry, spoilers, one of the twists in that episode is she's a con artist.
Yeah, she was totally out to like basically rob them all blind.
So there is actually something a little clever about using this "we accidentally got married" story and then explaining why it went so easily and artificially.
Yeah, but I feel like there's still ones that kind of use that type of thing. I guess I just get frustrated with stories of any kind that I'm like, okay, so this is going to happen, then this is going to happen, then this is going to happen, and that kind of the predictable nature of them.
I think what readers are frustrated with, and let's use that example, "We Accidentally Got Married," with that as a trope, quote unquote, is its use as a source of conflict and making things harder for characters in a way the reader finds unpleasant. I think readers will accept anything as long as it delights them, as long as it leads somewhere that they find interesting and fun to read. You know, you look at fan fiction, how many stories are there where we have to share the same hotel room and there's only one bed? You can use that a million times and people are still into it because they want to read about, I don't know, these characters hooking up or whatever. It's interesting. Like, lately there's been a lot of talk about low conflict stories and stories that are just kind of slice of life. People seem to want these. And I get that, because often when I'm watching a horror movie, the horror movie will spend the first 15 minutes or so setting up the characters. Then a slasher will arrive, or they'll go into a cave, or there'll be a ghost. And I'm often disappointed because I want the resolution of those threads set up in the first 15 minutes without a demon or a slasher or a ghost. I want to keep seeing these ordinary people's lives. So in a sense there, I'm frustrated by this trope in horror movies of them being horror movies, of there being this horrific presence that's going to cause death and destruction, when I just want to see these people work out their problems in a ordinary human way.
And I hate using this term, but like a reality TV, but like a real reality television, not the kind of pandering crap that's on.
Yeah, or like a mumblecore movie where half of it is improvised and it's just about people having, I don't know, regular dialogue about regular problems. And I think that ties back into the trope thing, because readers are irritated by... I haven't completely formed that thought yet.
You know, an interesting thing that I just kind of thought of about the whole trope thing is, I suppose it really also depends on your personal experience. To me, that drinking from the bowl thing was ridiculous because I've seen it so many times. But if I put that on for, you know, a kid who's like 12 and it's the first time he'd ever seen it, be like, oh my God, so crazy. Like, all he did was drink from this bowl and now they're married. So part of it's just kind of is it a trope, or is it just I've seen it more than maybe someone else, or
that right? Kind of. And some of it is also our cultural framework, where we modern middle-class Americans or whatever, we believe that issues should be solved by clear communication and everybody making a mental model of everybody else and thinking about what they know and how they think. You know, I should understand your point of view when we argue, and that's how we get the best resolution. Whereas there have been culture is such a powerful force that in a lot of places, ritual is very important and respecting ritual. And it might be that to somebody with another mindset, drinking from the bowl and completing the marriage is the important part. So what frustrates us about this scenario is we're thinking, why didn't Malcolm Reynolds just say, hey, I didn't understand this ritual. I undertook it without full knowledge of what it meant. Can I get a do-over? Can I back out? Mm-hmm. Whereas in another culture, it might be like, dude, you have to take this seriously. You did this really vital symbolic thing. It's meaningful. You have to respect it. Which is a cultural place that's very different from ours mentally. So actually, one example I thought of when you were talking about things you've seen a million times is like on Star Trek. They have all these episodes where in Deep Space Nine where they have to fight the Klingons. The Klingons are proud warriors. And one of the parts of them being proud warriors who love glory is they like to use swords. So they'll like beam onto the enemy spaceship or onto Deep Space Nine and attack our heroes with swords. And, you know, our heroes shoot them with guns and we're like, God, that's stupid. What kind of actual warrior would be like, I don't want to use guns. I only like sword. But the Portuguese, when they invaded the Indian Ocean Trade Network and started taking over big chunks of territory over there for colonies, the Portuguese knights actually refused to use cannon in a lot of situations because they wanted to get in there with swords and hack people up. And also because they wanted loot. And they were like, if we just shell things with cannons, they'll burn, they'll break. We want to get in there with our swords, kill people and take their stuff. So if I watched a fantasy show today that was like, ah, warriors only use swords, no guns, I'd think it was dumb. But in real history, I mean, that happens.
Yeah, and I mean, I think even the samurai were kind of still using swords prominently when, you know, muskets and rifles were just being kind of becoming normal.
Yeah, that's a complicated bit of history. I don't know that much about it.
So do you said that sometimes you use history when you're creating, you know, not to use the world building, but world building. Do you try to kind of pick certain parts of history or kind of mix a little bit of, you know, the Portuguese with the Mongols with this to kind of make it less like them? Or do you just try to kind of find more obscure stuff?
I try not to do either one-to-one fantasy Portugal, fantasy Mongol lifts, or patchwork quilts of like, these are medieval Polish people, but with the ball game played by Mesoamerican people. Actually, I kind of have done that. Now that I'm thinking about it, it kind of sucks. But what I try to do is I just try to use history as a metric of how weird things should be.
Yeah.
And if I look at a fantasy world I've created and say, this doesn't seem as complicated and weird as real history, I don't then steal a bunch of real history directly. I just look at the things that are weird about real history and try to take those patterns and put them in the fantasy world, but in a way that's specific to the world. So I might notice that a common theme in world history is that the ruler must maintain the support of their military and various other institutions by dealing out patronage. And it's important to distribute this patronage among like your palace guard and your army and your sources of water and your farmers and stuff in such a way that all of them depend on you for power, but no single group is getting so much of your power that they can just get rid of you. I am not then going to take the like Chinese emperor and ministries set up and port that directly into a fantasy world. But I am going to say, when I make up my own weird government for these people, it should require the same principle of the ruler needing to distribute power far enough that he's indispensable to everyone and can't be killed and overthrown. Or if I read in history that the Persians had a series of weak rulers brought down by harem intrigue, I'm probably not then going to write a series of emperors with a complicated harem that's constantly assassinating them. But I might be like, I should pay attention to the families of rulers and figure out how the society's ideas of inheritance play into who gets to be the next emperor or whatever. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah. I mean, to kind of throw it back to Game of Thrones, I mean, I feel like a lot of that was about the king is dead, who has the real claim?
Yes, which is very historically accurate.
Yeah. So I've talked with a ton of people through the course of the past, we on 6 months now? I think we're on 6 months now.
Yeah.
Of lockdown. Has it been a positive thing to your creativity or a negative thing? Me personally, I up until maybe a month ago, I have not been working creatively much at all. I just started on some art projects with my daughter as inspiration. It just kind of happened that we started working on some stuff together, and it's been amazing because it's really kind of brought me back around. But I've talked to other people who've been like, oh, it's great, I'm writing tons of music, or, you know, I'm working on all these things that I kind of had shelved. Has it been a good thing or a bad thing for you creative wise?
I would say it's bad, but I'd also struggled with depression for quite a few years before I got like kind of a good drug mix that worked for me.
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways, just being able to sit in my house and not do much and feel okay about it is a really nice experience, even if my creative output is down. Like, the fact that I'm not constantly gnawing at myself to do more and like, why do you suck so much? Why are you just sitting there? You should be writing.
I'm sorry, my thoughts were just in my ear. It's exactly what I like when COVID started. I dealt with my depression as making sure my calendar was always full and I was always busy and had lots of, so when things shut down, I was just like, you need to get out of bed and do things and stop being such a layabout. And it was the first few months were very, very difficult.
Yeah. I'm sorry. That sucks.
Oh, but things are better. So, I mean, peaks and valleys.
Yes. Yes. Swings and roundabouts.
So you were saying it wasn't great for you, but you're feeling good about taking that break. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah. I used to write really, really fast and a lot. And I kind of lost all my confidence and stopped writing for a while, which is bad because I was on contract for several books. And I've been kind of rebuilding from there. And lately what I've been doing is, people will often tell you, you have to write every day to be a real writer. You have to force yourself to do it. Maybe that works for some people. It doesn't work for me. I can't write when I'm miserable. It's been very important for me to have the ability to consciously not write. To say, instead of sitting here for 5 hours browsing the internet and feeling like shit because I'm not working, at the start of those 5 hours, I'm going to realize I'm not productive today and say, I am spending today resting, not feeling guilty. Has been really good for me.
That's actually some pretty good advice, because when things were busy and when I wasn't home, it was easy to have a day where nothing was going on and be like, oh, today's a relaxed day. I'm just going to chill and not do anything. But now we're home is my natural state of existence. It's hard to kind of separate the down and active time because it's there's no change.
Yeah. Like, I can't go to the coffee shop and be like, I'm writing now, and then come home and be like, I'm on break.
Right.
There's no physical barrier between those two anymore.
So when you write, do you always, obviously not now, but before, go to a coffee shop? Did you have an office? Do you have a home office to kind of separate your mental states like that?
No, our apartment is really small and kind of gross because we're in New York and everything's really expensive. I just have a chair. I write in my chair. And my partner has customized my chair for me. She's given it various upgrades so it stops falling apart when I sit in it. But the answer to your question, do I always go out to write? No. I will go wherever I am being productive. And often I find that after a couple weeks working in a coffee shop, I don't know. It runs dry for me and I need to go somewhere else or I need to go back home. Maybe because my brain learns it can cheat. You know, at the beginning I'm in a coffee shop and it's a new place and there's new people and I've got to write so I look like a real writer. But, you know, after a couple of weeks I'm like, you know, I could just sit here and drink coffee. Nobody would notice.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. I just got to keep mixing it up.
But I mean, that's probably what it is. I mean, everyone kind of has their own format for how they work. And if it takes a not constantly, but periodic change to the setting. I mean, that if that works for you, that's, I suppose that's the only advice you can ever really give, is what works for you. Figure out what makes you a productive person.
Yeah, definitely. One thing I will say is that having blockers that I can't turn off, that just shut off everything on the internet for like even 90 minutes a day, has been incredibly helpful. So I was trained as a psychologist before I got into this whole writing thing. And one of the truths of psychology is that humans are really, really bad at multitasking and task switching. We can think we're good at it. Like, you know, I'll watch this TV show while I write and it won't damage anything, but it's actually terrible because you get most of your productivity done in a flow state where the task occupies just about all your resources, but not so much that you're overwhelmed. And you can't get into that flow state if you're constantly being distracted or constantly, you know, switching to Twitter every 5 minutes. It'll just never happen. So having a universal shut the internet off button that I can't get around for a certain amount of time every day was really, really good for me.
I totally relate to what you're saying. It's like, I listen to podcasts when I'm, you know, sending out emails and just working on things and whatnot. And if I'm in that flow state, the podcast is on, but it's more just background noise. So I'm sitting in silence. But if I'm not, then I'm not as productive and I'm listening to the podcast and which I enjoy, obviously. So yeah, it's a weird kind of like trick to find, almost to kind of fool your brain into like that flow state, like what specifically triggers that flow state and how to stay in it.
Yeah. And I think, I know I've conditioned myself to switch tasks every 30 seconds or so. Like, I'll finish a sentence or a paragraph and be like, time to check Twitter. and I just have to deny myself the ability to do that. I have to make it so every time my brain wants to get distracted, I'm bounced back to the page. And the only thing I can do to avert boredom is either, I listen to music, but is either sit there and think or type.
Yeah, I've never heard of that internet blocker. And it's funny, I've always said that when I go out for drinks with friends, I need that kind of text blocker on my phone that I don't start texting people and you know, the wee hours after too many beers.
Yeah, relatable. I use an app called Freedom, which I think there's a trial version and then you pay for a full version, and it's not much. And you can spread it across your devices and set up different block lists. So I have one that's like, I can never look at Twitter, ever. And I can't change that. It's locked in. It on none of my devices can I access Twitter.
Oh, I feel like we should all get together and pitch in for Trump.
But then I have another block list that I can turn on while this other Twitter block is running. That's like, for the next 90 minutes, my computer is totally offline and I can't change that. And that's for like, sit down, write for 90 minutes, get your 2,000 words for the day, feel good about yourself. That's my, I don't know, productivity hack.
That's a pretty good tip, I think. And so hopefully our listeners will at least give that a shot. Where can people go online to find out more information? Where can they get your novel? All that self-promote-y type stuff.
You can get The Traitor, Baru Cormorant, wherever. The latest one is called The Tyrant. The first one is The Traitor. The Traitor, Baru Cormorant in the U.S., just The Traitor in the U.K. I don't know why. Traitor, like a betrayer, not a seller of goods. You can get it wherever convenient for you. Local bookshop is probably the best for you. Book Depository, Amazon if you've got to. But the most important part of buying a book is leave a review on Goodreads and Amazon. Doesn't have to be a good review. Doesn't have to be 5 stars. Just whatever you think. Because the algorithm Amazon uses to recommend books to other people does not kick in until you have a certain number of reviews on your product.
Oh, really?
So more, arguably more important than even buying the book is leaving a review. Yeah, so even if you pirate it, which I'm not condoning, but if that happens for whatever reason, leave a review and you'll help the book sell more copies. Books sell so few copies compared to any other type of media that it's one of the places where you, an individual, can actually make a huge difference to an author's career. Even if you convince only two other people to read it, and get two more reviews on Amazon, that could translate into hundreds more copies sold if the Amazon algorithm decides it likes you.
Wow, so, that's, it's so, like, times have changed, man. It's so, musicians and authors, I feel like, need to get together and be like, all right, what's the new world going to look like? Because it's every time I talk to them, they're all like, yeah, it's just so weird. It's not at all like it used to be. And your fate is kind of in that algorithm.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, so our listeners should go leave a review then on Amazon for your stuff. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. It's been a lot of fun. Yeah, and you're welcome back. Yeah, if you have another book, reach out. We'll come on and talk about it and stuff.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
Yeah, take care.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. You can find us on all social medias at InebriArt or on Instagram at InebriArt6. You can email us at InebriArt@yahoo.com. And make sure you listen to the other podcasts on the InebriArt Podcast Network, including Bar Talk, Old Colony Cast, Retro Redoctopus, America's Hometown Horror Podcast, and our newest one, Theme Park Legends, a podcast about working at theme parks. What else? And we'll catch you again next time.